The following program may contain material that is unsuitable for some audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Aftermath Radio should not be considered a substitute for services provided by a licensed mental health professional. Good afternoon and welcome to Aftermath Radio, brought to you live from the K-Beach radio station at Cal State Long Beach.
Good afternoon. Here we are, Aftermath Radio. What are you laughing about so soon? That was a pretty good fade, actually. That was almost professional.
Thanks.
I liked it. Dr. Robert Shug here, Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice and Forensic Psychology here at Long Beach State. Coming at you with Aftermath Radio, where we talk about all things psychopathic. And this is our very special holiday edition of Aftermath Radio.
Is that a hint for me?
Holiday edition. Now, usually the two of you will email me like during the week before and say, hey, Dr. Shug, you need anything for the show this week? And I guess we were like ships that passed in the night this week, right? So we really didn't get the memo out about holiday music. So I found the most non-denominational, politically correct holiday theme song I could find.
Is it really?
Jingle Bells? Yeah.
It doesn't mean
no,
it's not
there's
Christmas-y?
No. Well, I mean, there's no mention of any particular deity or faith, right? It's just, you're in a sled.
Just bells.
Yeah.
Jingling.
Really. Could be anyone.
I kind of like this in the back.
All right, I think that's enough. If you'd like to speak with us here at Aftermath Radio, our phone number is area code 562-912-3541. That's 562-912-3541. You can Skype us at aftermath.radio. Chantel Fahmy is chatting with Chant as we speak. Anyone checking in, Chant?
I'm not sure who I'm allowed to say.
Oh, no one. That would be a no one.
no one
by name.
At least you said it correctly this time.
I did. Yeah, I've been practicing.
Show, you got it right.
I practiced, right. You can email us at aftermathradio@kbeach.com. And as always, we encourage you to check out our website at aftermathradio.org, where we have all of our podcasts archived for your listening entertainment, your listening pleasure. This is the last show of 2011. I don't know how you ladies feel about that. You sad? Do we need to process some negative affect here? No.
It's gone by so quick, I can't even.
It really has. You know, we've done a lot of work. If you go to the website, I'm not just kind of, you know, plugging the website, but if you did happen to go to the website, there's a lot there.
Yeah. It feels like, you know, this is going to be a good ending.
Yeah, let's hope so. A really nice bookend to the shelf of books we've compiled
right.
This semester. That's a horrible analogy. Anyway, I'm really excited about it. We got tons to do today. I'm just speechless. We have my three favorite guests in the world, Dr. Dave Cossin, Dr. Leanne Liedem, and Dr. Paul Babiak, who are going to come on. We're doing the Wheel of Controversy. And I saw Gigi Brar out in the back today oiling up the Wheel of Controversy. Did you get that thing working?
Let's see.
All right. Let's have Sounds pretty good.
Yep.
The crowd's excited. We haven't used that thing in a long time, too.
It's one of my
favorites. It's raining out here. It's out there in the alley resting, so I'm glad you got that in and ready to go. Okay, so we're going to do that at the bottom of the hour. Oh, and also, since I know that Dr. Paul Babiak is listening right now, he usually listens with his wife, the Aftermath Radio Disclaimer, which I've edited for our special holiday edition.
Okay, so here it goes.
Mm-hmm.
Though you cannot make a conclusive diagnosis of psychopathy without adequate interview and file information, several of the behaviors reported in this case seem broadly consistent with traits and characteristics commonly associated with psychopathy. None of the comments made here should be interpreted as a formal diagnosis based on an appropriate psychopathy assessment.
There you go. Straight from the Aftermath Radio Legal Department.
Very well done.
I threatened him that I would change the music behind that every time, and I think I might just
stick to that.
I'll probably be calling it. He'll probably email me any minute now. Anyway, we'll be talking to Paul in a few minutes. Now, what I wanted to do with the rest of the first segment, I happen to know the categories that are on the Wheel of Controversy today.
Wow. lucky.
Because this show is all about planned spontaneity. That's how I see our role here. Planned spontaneity, right? So I know what the categories are, and I happen to know that one of the categories deals with the DSM.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. We need that sound bit, don't we?
Like
a dramatic sound thing. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, put out by the American Psychiatric Association. What year was the original DSM put out? Do you know? Just take a guess.
1921.
1921, G?
1950. No, 1866.
I don't know.
Now you guys are just guessing. You're just guessing. The original DSM, the DSM-1, came out in 1952.
See, I was close.
Because you were closer.
I learned this for our final tonight.
However, Chantal Fahmy over there was probably thinking of the European version, the ICD, the International Classification of Diseases, which originally came out in the 1850s.
1866.
So we're both half right.
1853, the ICD comes out.
Exactly,
right?
What I was thinking.
And by the way, so we're talking about the DSM is the diagnostic system that psychiatrists and psychologists and mental health professionals use to diagnose mental disorders. And it's what we use here in the United States, and I believe they use it in Canada and I think Japan and maybe a few other countries. But other countries use different versions of these classification systems, and the ICDs is the most popular one, I think, in other countries. And what they do with these things is they update them every so often, and they're supposed to be based on research. So we put these things out, not we. I mean, the APA puts this out, and they do a bunch of research, and then they kind of tweak it. And as the years go on, we get different versions. Now, the DSM is currently in its fourth revision. Actually, I think you would call it its fourth version. It's called the TR, the text revision, I believe is the proper way to say that, right? So the DSM-5 is this thing that's sort of looming on the horizon right now. Everyone's really excited about the DSM-5. What's going to be in the DSM-5? I don't know. Gee, what's going to be in the DSM-5? Do you know?
Nobody knows.
Nobody knows, right? And they have this, I think we'll be talking about this later, they have a website where you can track different disorders in the DSM, and because what's happening are people are doing a bunch of field trials or experiments and trying to figure out if these diagnoses hold up. So when the DSM-5 comes out, you know, it'll be based on current research. And they've been threatening to release the DSM-5 now, I think, for the past 3-4 years. So
I was going to say, I have two questions. One,
yes.
when do we really think it's going to come out?
I don't know. The politically correct thing to say would be as soon as all the research has been completed.
Mm. And the second question, how similar or different are the DSM from the ICD? Is that what you said?
So they're surprisingly similar, although some of the terminology has changed about, you know. You can look in the DSM and find sort of an equivalent to most of everything in the ICD, except if they'll just have different names. Mm-hmm. You know, like, for example, antisocial personality disorder in the DSM is called dissocial personality disorder in the ICD, which is now the ICD-10.
Ahead of their stuff.
Yeah, they beat the DSM.
Well, they've had it for a little bit longer.
Yeah, they've been around for, well, about they had about 100 years head start, right? So what ends up happening, actually in the United States, believe it or not, our first official systems came in 1840 when the census, the United States Census in 1840, had a category called idiocy and insanity. It was a diagnostic category. To be an idiot back then wasn't like a pejorative term. It meant you had some sort of mental deficiency. You waving or you just like doing
the
high five?
Already five minutes?
Wow,
yes.
Okay. Wow, this goes fast. In 1880 census in the United States, there were 7 categories of mental illness. And then so the DSM comes out in 1952, and originally the DSM-1 and the DSM-2 were they were based on kind of psychoanalytic approaches to understanding what they called war neuroses, or PTSD now is what they call it, or shell shock has been another name for it. And so these initial versions of the DSM were kind of warm-ups or, you know, I don't want to say rough drafts, but basically you get into the DSM-3 where it really starts to be a research-based document. Anyway, so I know that one thing we'll be talking about later is where does psychopathy fit into the DSM? And traditionally, it does not. Which is sort of strange. Now, in the original version of the DSM, the DSM-1, which came out in 1952, they had something called sociopathic personality disturbance. And they distinguished between an antisocial and a dissocial sociopath. Now, that's part of, I think, where the confusion comes with this word sociopath and the term psychopath and how people sometimes jumble them up or And on this show, we sort of, this is my personal opinion, we should just be using that one term, psychopath, because we don't know how to measure sociopath, I think, in an empirically validated way. Anyway, the DSM-2 comes out, and they start calling it antisocial personality traits. They drop the term sociopath altogether. And in the DSM-3, they go with antisocial personality disorder formally. Now, the reason there was this change initially is because in the first versions of the DSM, the DSM-1 and the DSM-2, clinicians were having a really tough time with the diagnosis. It was psychoanalytically based. It was thought not to be so valid because a lot of the personality features were sort of hard to assess, and the clinicians probably weren't doing such a good job at it. So the DSM-3, which came out in 1980, they made it purely sort of a behavioral list. This behavior, this behavior, this behavior, this behavior, and they called it antisocial personality disorder. Well, a bunch of folks got really mad at that because all of this, personality features that, if we even use the word sociopath, that all kind of got lost, and we were just talking about behaviors. But it turns out it's much easier diagnosis to make, and that's an argument for having it in there or not having it in there. Do we want a diagnosis that captures the true essence of psychopathy but it's difficult to assess, or do we want something that's much easier that folks can do but maybe you're kind of losing some of the nuances? So that's kind of the back and forth, and I think we're going to talk about that. I think it's on the wheel of controversy. Wink, wink, if you know what I mean. And by the way, psychopathy is mentioned once in the current version of the DSM on page 702. For those of you that are keeping track, it says this pattern, and it's talking about antisocial personality disorder. This pattern has also been referred to as psychopathy, sociopathy, or dissocial personality disorder. Hmm. Nothing confusing about that, is there?
You said page 700 and...
Page 702.
How many pages are in the DSM?
About 5,000. No, it's not that many. It's very, seriously about this thick.
Whoa.
Probably 4 inches thick. Yeah.
That our listeners can see how thick.
See that? That's the hardcover version, though. The paperback might be a little bit thinner. So there you go. So there's this kind of debate now about whether psychopathy should go in the DSM. And I don't want to steal the thunder of what might be a question for our guests later. But I'm sure that's going to be an interesting discussion right there. All right. So there's a short sort of condensed Reader's Digest version of the history of the DSM, as well as how psychopathy fits into it. Any questions, ladies?
I mean, you know me. I always have questions, but now that we're out of time, I'll have to ask you.
You can ask me during the commercial.
There you go.
Aftermath Radio, we'll be right back after this.
Hi, my name is Bob, and I'm a psychopath.
Hi, Bob!
Bob!
Know what a psychopath is? Do you have one in your life? How would you know? Join Dr. Robert Shug Mondays at 4 p.m. for Aftermath Radio and get the facts about psychopathy.
We are back. Aftermath Radio, Dr. Robert Shug, Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice and Forensic Psychology at Cal State Long Beach, here on the holiday edition of Aftermath Radio. That's your QG.
Oh, sorry. Missed it.
If you'd like to call us at Aftermath Radio, the phone number here is area code 562-912-3541. That's 562-912-3541. You can Skype us at aftermath.radio and chant with chat with chant.
Yes.
Keep going.
And now I'm on Santa's naughty list, right? You can email us at aftermathradio@kbeach.com. And as always, check out our podcast at our website, aftermathradio.org. In the lower left-hand corner is a link to where our podcasts are archived. Yeah, I'm going to start taking hostages if I keep hearing that, I think. All right, we have on the line Jane from Wiltshire. Jane, are you there?
Jane is here.
Jane, you are here. Hey, by the way, Jane, can I tell everyone that you sent me a Christmas card?
Or yeah, is that not? It's crazy.
I like the.
Yeah, go on.
Where did you get the puffy stickers?
Everywhere. It's funny how you might wonder where the message kind of starts and where it ends, and me sticking things.
It's
at
very,
the back and,
yeah, it's very creatively, you know. Laid out. Right now, but Jane actually. She asked a good question in amongst the Christmas card writing. She said, how many of those shopping mall Santa Clauses are psychopaths?
I was being chatty. It was always like not a serious question, but
I was.
We could think about it.
I was in the mall actually over the weekend, and I saw the shopping mall Santa Claus that's in our local mall, and I was wondering that actually. I was like, I'm wondering where do they find these guys and how well do they screen them? So,
well, I think maybe I'm going to propose that the prevalence for psychopathy among people dressed up as Santas would be higher than the population average, because it's a casual job and they might be motivated to apply because they think, this is going to make me look nice in the community. I'm so kind.
There you go. I like how you tied that in to the psychopathy theme. That was good. I thought you were just going to say because they were weird or something like that. And we don't want to offend any shopping mall Santas by any means. Anyway, so Jane, we brought you on today to talk about a little bit more about what happened to you. And in particular, we're going to talk about some of the lying that you had to sort of sort through when you were involved with a psychopathic individual. Could you just briefly sum up what happened to you in terms of, you know, what the relationship was about, and then tell us about some of the lying that you experienced?
So I first knew this man because of where I worked, what my job was. Actually, it was a work placement. I was still young, so it was a temporary position. And he worked there. I mean, he was taking up a permanent position there. He was Catholic, or he said he was Catholic. He was a churchgoer, and so I thought we had the same faith. I've been from a non-Catholic Christian background, so I went along to his church. I dated him, arguably briefly. He was my boyfriend for a while, and what's the other thing? Church work
Someone that you a previous dating relationship.
Pardon?
It was a previous dating relationship. In other words, okay. So then you mentioned, and you and I have spoken by email about some of the lies that you were subjected to. Why don't you tell us a little bit about those?
Yes, well, an overview of the different lies. He kept on saying to all of the colleagues, including me, including both of my line managers and everyone, that he owned these three restaurants that were, I don't know, maybe 25 minutes walk away from where we worked. I believed him, and we believed him, and yeah, he kept on saying he owned these three vegetarian restaurants. But one day, I ended up visiting one of them, and I figured out it wasn't true at all, and he didn't own any of them. He kept on lying about being the director of a construction company. There was no construction company. He kept on saying he employed 150 people in his construction business. It just didn't exist. The corporate records said he was never a director of anything. He was very active in the Catholic Church. He kept on advising the Catholic priest about financial matters, about how to handle money and stuff, which was what was going on. He kept on lying about what his name was inside the Catholic Church for years and years.
Wow.
He kept on giving financial advice, even though he had four criminal convictions for theft that one day I stumbled upon.
That's interesting, because these all sound like lies that could be very easily checked on. Like you say, the restaurants were reasonably close to where you worked, yet he still sort of had courage or lack of a better word.
Being so close to the truth and yet so far away from it. And one of the two line managers that I reported to at work, you know, she was a nice lady, and she even said to me once that, I've gone to one of his restaurants as a customer before, and I was just being sociable and friendly and saying, what was that like? And she said, well, don't really know how to describe describe that to you. It's like I could have, I might never have figured out that he was lying about the restaurants if I didn't walk that way that day. I could have found out months earlier that, I don't know, when friends were coming to our town and we were planning on where to go for fun and
sure.
stuff, I could have figured out together with my friends, which would have been, was kind of more embarrassing as well.
Now, did you ever confront him with these lies? Did you ever say, hey, I was at that restaurant and they don't even know who you are? Or anything like that?
Yes. After 8.5 months, on that Sunday, I went there and just all the staff across all three places all said they didn't know this guy, you know, by this name. And I even described his physical appearance, like he's quite tall, he's got long hair, he's quite slim, you know.
He sounds very dreamy.
They didn't have a clue what I was talking about, and they even thought, like, why is this girl here? Oh, is she applying for a weekend job and stuff? And I was really confused and I was really distressed. But right. then I still had to be quite polite to them. And
well, I was wondering if you actually confronted him with the lies.
You know, I did confront him.
And then what was his reaction?
Hours afterwards, it was at his workplace, which was where I used to work. That's a whole conversation, really.
Well, how did that go when you confronted him with that information?
Or you could say that he confronted me and not I confronted him. So once I figured it out, in the next couple of hours, I kept on calling him, getting no answer, texting him. Then the next day was actually a Monday, right? And kept on texting him saying, why did you lie to me about these restaurants? You didn't own them. And and also actually on the Monday, it's odd because somehow I also figured out that he had been targeting this girl at work too, and trying to get her out on dates. But it was in the afternoon, mid afternoon, kind of coming towards late afternoon, and I was at reception. I didn't actually go into the place to talk to him at all. It wasn't my intention. I was going to speak to this this girl. Well, she wouldn't want me to say too much about her. But
no. Well, what did he
been targeted by him. I was there to talk to her, not him. And he grabbed me. He grabbed me for a conversation, and it was a conversation that was a few minutes, and that was it. And then he just wanted to cut off contact.
I see. Did he respond with more lies then? Because sometimes when we talk about pathological liars, how if you catch them in a lie, the first thing they do is they tell another lie. Is that what he did?
No. He started off by trying to tell me off that I had become such a threat to him, that I was writing letters, giving the priest letters, talking about him, about the restaurants, he didn't use lies to cover lies. But what really got me, what annoyed me so much was that, okay, I said, why did you lie to me about the restaurants?
Mm-hmm.
So about the restaurants, he didn't lie more. He just said, okay, well, if that's what you think, you know, that I lied about the restaurants. But what annoyed me so much was that there was never a point when he admitted that, yeah, I lied about the restaurants.
So he
you know
sort
what
of,
I mean?
Right, he tried to throw it back onto you and make you seem like the bad person, sounds like, in a way. Like sort of accusing you of irrational behavior. Yeah.
On that day, he did lie about loads of things.
I see.
He made up loads of things, but not relating to the lies about the restaurants, the three restaurants.
Right. All right, then, Jane, you know, we're just about out of time, but wanted to thank you for calling in again. It's always good to hear from you.
And in a way, we've kind of gone off topic, because I was going to talk about the most unbelievable aspects of his life. But we can save that.
We'll save that for 2012. How about that?
Pardon?
We'll save that for 2012, for next year.
Yeah. All right.
You have a happy holidays then.
Yeah, you too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay. All right. Bye.
Bye. There you go. Have either of you two ever known a pathological liar? Chantal, Gigi?
Yes.
It's frustrating, isn't it?
It's sad that you get to a point. It's sad that you get to a point where literally every single thing that comes out of their mouth, you just have to go, I just don't believe it.
Yeah.
And you just automatically resort to that, and you need constant proof of everything.
I wonder why it is, too. Sometimes those folks, even when the truth wouldn't get them in trouble, why they go for the lie. It's almost like an anxiety thing. I'm just speculating here, of course, but...
I mean, I'll share a personal story. There was this guy that I was dating at one point, and it's just everything was not only a lie, but it was exaggerated. Like, I wouldn't know if there was any truth to anything he was saying, and it was until he would show me otherwise that I would believe it.
Yeah.
It was just constant.
Did you confront him?
No, but that's a whole different story.
That's for 2012.
Yeah.
2012 is already starting to be a big year. All right, should we go to break?
Yes, sir.
Okay, Aftermath Radio, we'll be right back after this.
Hi, my name is Bob, and I'm a psychopath.
Hi, Bob!
Bob!
Do you know what a psychopath is? Do you have one in your life? How would you know? Join Dr. Robert Shugg Mondays at 4 p.m. for Aftermath Radio and get the facts about psychopathy.
We are back, Aftermath Radio. Dr. Robert Shugg, Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice and Forensic Psychology here at Long Beach State. If you'd like to speak with us, area code 562-912-3541. Skype us at aftermath.radio. Email us at aftermathradio@kbeach.com. Now, we have on the line our three guests for the Wheel of Controversy today. Are my three guests there?
Yes.
Excellent.
Yeah.
All right. Let me get the introductions out of the way then. First, we have Dr. Dave Cossin, professor of psychology at Rosalind Franklin University of Medicine and Science. He is one of the co-authors of the Psychopathy Checklist Youth Version and has authored over 50 articles on psychopathy. His research focuses primarily on the cognitive, emotional, and interpersonal mechanisms underlying psychopathy. Hello, Dave.
Hi, Robert.
How are you doing tonight?
Good.
All right, next we have Lan Leadham, Dr. Lan Leadham, a psychiatrist, graduated from the University of Southern California Keck School of Medicine. She trained in psychiatry at Harbor UCLA and Yale New Haven Hospital. Currently, she is visiting professor of counseling at the University of Bridgeport. She's on the board of directors of the Aftermath Surviving Psychopathy Foundation and is author of Just Like His Father, A Guide to Overcoming Your Child's Genetic Connection to Antisocial Behavior, Addiction and ADHD, and Women Who Love Psychopaths. Hi, Leanne.
Hello.
And last but not least, of course, we have Dr. Paul Babiak, industrial and organizational psychologist in private practice in New York. Dr. Babiak coaches and consults to executives and organizations on leadership development issues. He's author with Robert Hare of the book Snakes in Suits, When Psychopaths Go to Work. He's also authored several scientific papers and book chapters and speaks about the corporate psychopath to audiences around the world. How are you doing, Paul?
I'm great.
It's good to have you guys. Sound so clear tonight, too. I don't know if it's the weather or what. It's great.
It's not the weather here or there, as I hear.
No, probably not here.
It must be AT&T.
Very good. We're happy to have you all back. It's been a while since we've had you all in one place.
It has been.
So we're going to do the Wheel of Controversy. We do the standard approach. We spin the wheel. The topic comes up, and then the three of you battle it out. How's that sound?
Good.
All right. G, why don't you give the wheel a spin?
Seems like the audience is rowdy tonight.
They are. Well, it's today's finals week, so they're all amped up. You know, these kids and their caffeinated beverages. That was a joke, G, by the way.
Oh, I was laughing. My mic's off, so I'm laughing.
All right. First topic, should psychopathy be in the DSM-5? Wow. Now, full disclosure, I did sort of set this up for you all. I don't know if anyone's listening at the beginning of the show. So the audience is now up to date on what the DSM is and how psychopathy has fit in to the different versions thus far. So I guess we'll go to Dave.
I think psychopathy absolutely belongs in the DSM-5. Psychopathy is the personality disorder about which we know the most. It's been studied the longest. There's the most extensive evidence about it, and it's criminal that it isn't in the DSM yet.
Pardon the pun.
Yeah. Okay, so one vote yes. Liam, what do you think?
I think yes.
You guys aren't...
And to make things easier, I think that we should also adopt some sort of a dimensional measure of it so that people can be placed along a continuum of severity.
Okay. Because like all other mental disorders, these things tend not to be categorical. Either you have them or you don't.
Right. That there are various degrees to which someone is affected. And I could go off on that tangent if you want. But otherwise, you come back to me about that. I read something interesting over the weekend about that.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll come back to you. We might just need that tangent. All right. And Paul, what do you think?
Well, I have to agree with both Dave and Leanne for all the reasons that they give. But I would add, it's been over 30 years that research has been done, possibly longer if you include Cleckley's work on psychopathy. So we really do know a lot of it. It's been measured in all cultures. It's distinct. It's not related to national origin or race or anything like that, so it's a pretty pure measure. I do agree we should look at it because it truly is dimensional. But the reason I want to throw in the pile here is that many people, when they look for psychopathy on the Internet, they end up at a variety of places. Wikipedia is one, but there's lots of other lesser places, and they learn about it, and they learn a lot of bad stuff. And I think the DSM is the place where experts go for information, psychiatrists, psychologists, and many lay people, as well as social workers and teachers and people like that. So I think it should definitely be in that book, because that is the one source of real research-based information about mental disorders, and I think psychopathy fits in perfectly.
So it's a place where they can get sort of the standardized version.
Exactly.
Research-based. Okay.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
All right. So all three of you are agreeing, and this makes it for horrible radio. I was hoping for some...
But, you know, there's still a controversy about how to get it in there. You know, I mean, have you guys already talked about what's currently on the table for the DSM-5?
We have not, no. Would you like to speak about that?
Well, I think it's probably worth putting on the table. As I understand it, and I'll let the others correct me if I'm not up to date, the current draft proposal for the DSM-5 is to not put psychopathy up there, but to put antisocial personality disorder there, as it's been since 1980, and simply try to have a definition of antisocial personality disorder that does a somewhat better job of capturing the traits of psychopathy.
And what do you think of that method then, Dave?
Well, I think it's got some... I mean, I can understand one... there's at least one thing to recommend that method, which is the term psychopathy is so pejorative that people, you know... If someone wants to call someone a psychopath, they're usually doing it out of anger or to try to make somebody feel bad. You know, So antisocial personality disorder doesn't sound so bad, so it's got that going for it. But on the flip side, antisocial personality disorder has never been synonymous with psychopathy, at least since 1980, and that's led to a tremendous amount of heat. You know, a lot of criticism of the DSM-3 and 4, and so I feel like it's the new category or dimension is bound to have a lot of unnecessary baggage attached to it if we keep down the road we're on.
Right. As the lone psychiatrist in the group, I would like to say that for psychiatrists, I think that psychopathy has been synonymous with antisocial personality disorder because psychiatrists tend to look at things differently than psychologists. I think psychiatrists tend to be
more global and to view things as dimensional, whereas psychologists are very specific in how they define things. They're very specific that you have to meet certain criteria that are exact. And then they use those criteria to categorize people, whereas I think psychiatrists are more used to getting a global gestalt about someone and then thinking of them on a continuum of severity. So, I mean, I may be wrong, but that's my take on how psychiatry training, I think, is a little different. You know, we're not taught in the skills of psychological testing and exact measurement the way psychologists are.
Mm.
So I think that's why you have psychiatrists who'll say that they are the same, even though technically Dave's correct that if you use the exact definition, they're not the same. But for the most part, if you take the symptoms of antisocial personality disorder and you correlate them with the symptoms of psychopathy, the correlation is really pretty good.
Okay. Paul, did you want to weigh in?
yeah, I have a couple things to say. I would agree that psychologists, and I am a psychologist, we tend to go for the operational definition, which is usually an instrument of some sort. In psychopathy, the one that I use and many use is the psychopathy checklist. So I would agree with that that distinction between psychiatry and psychology. But what I find problematic in the DSM-4, and I don't have the TR version. I have just the regular DSM-4 with the red cover, as opposed to, I think, the blue or the gray cover. But what I find problematic is if you look at the criteria, 301.7, it's a box, and it lists 7 criteria. There are things that look and sound like psychopathic traits and characteristics, but there are also things that are missing. And you have to read the text to find some, not all of them. For instance, arrogant self-appraisal, glib superficial charm. These are very important to me, I believe, traits of a psychopath, and they're also fairly easily observable when you meet an individual who has psychopathy, yet they're not in the list. So the problem I think the DSM-4 presents someone doing a diagnosis is one person can read the box, check off which ones are here, and make a diagnosis. Another person can read the entire text and possibly come up with a different diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
So what I feel DSM-5 needs to do is to standardize it. If there are 10 items, fine, 15, 20, whatever they are, but come to agreement on the full list of the traits and characteristics, put them in the box, and then explain them in the text so that wherever you look, you get the same picture of the same kind of individual. Now, to the naming problem, I understand that, you know, there are people who have antisocial personality disorder who are not psychopaths. So ideally, in my mind, you'd have two. An antisocial personality disorder page, and you'd have a page on psychopathy. I don't think they're ever going to go that way. But I think a compromise would be to have antisocial personality disorder general and then antisocial personality disorder psychopathy subtype. And that way you can differentiate the two, because you'll have both of them in the DSM, and you'll be able to paint a very clear picture as to who's sitting in front of you when you're doing your diagnosis.
Okay. We got to actually go to a commercial. Can you all three hang on for another segment?
Sure.
Yes.
Okay. We'll be right back after Meth Radio.
Hi, my name is Bob, and I'm a psychopath.
Hi, Bob!
Bob!
Do you know what a psychopath is? Do you have one in your life? How would you know? Join Dr. Robert Shugg Mondays at 4 p.m. for Aftermath Radio and get the facts about psychopathy.
Aftermath Radio.
We are back, Aftermath Radio. We have on the line Dr. Dave Kossin, Dr. Leanne Liedem, and Dr. Paul Babiak. We are doing the Wheel of Controversy, and the question, the controversial question is, should psychopathy be in the new version, the DSM-5? And we've heard pretty much congruent viewpoints, I think, across the board, although everyone's making some really good points. Dave, I get the sense that we're not quite done with it yet. Did you have more to say?
I don't think what the... I don't think the current plan for the DSM-5 is going to get us to where we want to be. So that's one issue, one controversy. And the other issue is I suspect there's a disagreement between Leanne and I about the extent of the damage done in the previous editions of the DSM.
Well, let's go there, because I want some controversy between you two.
Always worth a shot.
Yeah.
If you look at the DSM-4... It will say, there'll be lines in there like, people with this diagnosis, that is antisocial personality disorder, are also commonly referred to as psychopathic or sociopathic. I'm not quoting, but it's lines to that effect, which give
right.
the impression that the architects of the DSM-3 and 4 believe they've got synonyms. But if you look at the research, about two-thirds to three-quarters of jail and prison inmates meet the diagnostic criteria for antisocial personality disorder. Whereas if you were to require a diagnostic cutoff for the psychopathy checklist, which again is arbitrary where you draw the line, but where people typically used to draw the line, it would only include about 25 to 30% of jail and prison inmates. So in other words, maybe half of those who meet the diagnostic criteria for antisocial personality disorder would meet the criteria for psychopathy. So that's really quite a big discrepancy.
Leanne, what do you have to say to that?
I don't consider the disorder to be much categorical at all. And I'll give you two examples of experts who agree with me. The first is Reed Malloy. And I was at a seminar that he gave over the weekend, and he quoted the same studies, and he put up the same Venn diagram showing that... using the categorical cutoff of 30, about 20 to 25% of inmates are psychopaths ending in S.
Hmm.
But then following that slide, he put up another slide that said that he views psychopathy as dimensional, and he scores it the following way. 10 to 20, is that about right? 10 to 20, I'm guessing on the numbers because now I'm blanking on exactly the cutoffs. But I know the bottom cutoff was 10. I think 10 to 20 he called mild psychopathy. 20 to 30 he called moderate psychopathy. And 30 and above he called severe psychopathy. And then above, so that group of 30 and above would be psychopaths.
Right. And by the way, Leanne's talking about the psychopathy checklist where out of 40 possible points, the cutoff traditionally is 30. So 30 out of 40. So what you're saying is Dr. Malloy is proposing these along a dimension, but mild, moderately, and severe, sounds
right.
like.
So, okay. And he's one of the premier criminologists. You know, he's a pure forensic psychologist.
Mm-hmm.
Working in the prison system has evaluated many, many criminals. And so by his scheme there of the mild, moderate, and severe, they would most criminals would be considered somewhat psychopathic, somewhere along those that continuum. That there aren't too many that fall that have scores below 10.
Right.
Now, okay, so that's Reed Malloy. The second person who I think is really saying the same thing but using psychoanalytic terminology is Otto Kernberg. And he places the same individuals along a very similar continuum. And his judge of mild, moderate, and severe, though, is the degree to which a person is able to have some sort of attachment to others.
Mm-hmm.
So he would consider a person mildly psychopathic if they showed psychopathic features but had some degree of attachment, and he would say someone is severely psychopathic if they had no attachment to others. Now, I really like that, but the question is, we don't know what the PCLR cutoff is. for familial dangerousness. And so until we know, I'm not prepared to say that individuals who seem to be only mildly psychopathic are only mild. In fact, in the seminar, I raised my hand and everyone laughed because I asked, is there really such a thing as mild psychopathy? We don't know the answer to that question. It may be that if we really studied this, that someone with a score of 12 would be dangerous to their family members.
That's true.
And so then that might cause us to relook at the disorder and the boundaries of severe. Severe means high risk for recidivist criminality and violence and repeat sex offending and all of that. But if you have one of these people in your family, you're not only interested in that. You're interested in, is this individual going to be dangerous to me in all of those domains, socially, physically, emotionally, psychologically, and financially? And we just don't have a number that equates to that.
Right. Now, we've got about 2 minutes left. Time always flies here. Dave, did you want to respond to that, or should we pass
over
to Paul?
I would just say that there is a lot of research which indicates that people with these middle-range scores on the psychopathy checklist measures can be differentiated from people with high scores on the psychopathy checklist in terms of crime, violence, recidivism, emotional deficits, and cognitive deficits. So I can't really disagree with Leanne that the people who have a moderate degree of psychopathy are very important. They really need to be studied. People who have people with moderate levels of psychopathic traits, certainly the people in their families and in relationships with them, certainly are going to want to get help. But those people are not the same as people with very high scores on psychopathy.
Okay. And then, Paul, let's just give you the last word then.
Well, not to disagree with Reed too much, and I wasn't there, so I don't know how he did his math, but he's talking about the psychopathy checklist, obviously, 20 items. And depending on which items you're scoring high on that load into your 20 to 30, your moderate range, I think is important to know. Because if, in my mind, somebody with a psychopathic personality tends to be high on factor one, interpersonal affective, which are the two domains. And you could be high on all of those, not be high on the others, and get a score of 20 to 25. The reverse is also true. You could be high on a deviant lifestyle, antisocial, which is factor two, which is, in my mind, is more of the antisocial personality disorder, as it's been defined, at least in the DSM, without having the personality traits that we commonly associate with psychopathy. So I guess what I'm saying is I want to see the math, and I want to see the distribution of scores along the items of any individual before I would say they're moderately psychopathic or even mildly psychopathic.
Right. Well, I think it's probably we could agree that we've just scratched the surface then, that maybe this should be something we talk about again in the future.
There are a number of issues we didn't have time for.
Okay, well, I smell another episode, right? All right, I want to thank all three of you for coming on. It's always great to have you all in the same place.
Do you mind if we keep arguing after you get on?
No, I encourage that, actually. I encourage it.
Oh, no, say no.
All right, you three, happy holidays to all of you.
Happy holidays.
And we'll talk to you again in the new year. All righty, bye-bye.
We should definitely have them back on one of the first episodes.
That'll be our first episode in the beginning of the year.
Yeah.
But speaking of the beginning of the year, and by the way, this is our holiday
already
edition of Aftermath Radio. Right, G?
I got it.
Right. What was I going to say? Oh, yeah, so this will be the last show for 2011, but we will be back at the end of January in 2012. We did actually get a call. You can probably nix that for a second. We got a call during the commercial break. A gentleman wanted to know if anyone out there has ever been able to, how did he put it, Chantel, to recoup money or
come out ahead?
Yeah, he's come out ahead.
Come out ahead in terms of struggling financially, I guess, or even maybe emotionally, interpersonally with a psychopath. I think I heard him actually describing dollar amounts. Has anyone ever actually been able to recoup their losses from a psychopath? And encouraging anyone to let us know about that, either email or call us in about that.
Also including perjury.
Oh, perjury as well.
Has there been, you know, when you're talking about pathological lying, has there been, you know, someone who's been able to come ahead even knowing that the psychopath has
right Right. Okay. Well, we'll put that out there as a theme for 2012. If you'd like to get a hold of the show during the break, you can always call us at 562-912-3541. That's 562-912-3541. Leave us a voicemail message or Skype us at aftermath.radio. You can email us at aftermathradio@kbeach.com. And as always, go to the website, aftermathradio.org, and click in the lower left-hand corner, and all of our podcasts are there for you to listen to over the break when you have nothing else to do. Right? Ladies, yes. Did you need to say anything else? Parting words for 2011?
Happy holidays. I need the break.
It's been a great year.
Yeah. Has been a great year. We're looking forward to next year, too, an even better year. I want to thank everyone for listening. We hope you have pleasant and safe holidays, and we'll look forward to talking with you at the beginning of the year. This is Aftermath Radio here on KBeach.
You've been listening to Aftermath Radio, production of the KBeach radio station at California State University, Long Beach. Produced in association with AftermathSurvivingPsychopathy.org. Your host has been Dr. Robert Shug. Your producers have been Brian Frederick, Chantel Fahmy, and Gurjeet Brar. Join us next Monday at 4 p.m. for another exciting episode.
If you or someone you know has been victimized and you'd like to talk to someone, call the Cal State Long Beach Counseling and Psychological Services number at 562-985-4001. Aftermath Radio.